Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE. The European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome back to New Books in Economics, part of the New Books Network. This is Andrea Bernardi, your host. Today I am with Miriam Dressen from Oxford University, and we are talking about a great new book, Tales of Hope, Tastes of Bitterness, published in 2019 by Hong Kong University Press. Welcome, Miriam. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Please tell us something about your affiliations, your current and past affiliations, and then about the origin of the book, how you ended writing a book on Chinese road builders in Ethiopia.
Oh, that's a very long story. Well, I'm currently a researcher in the China Law and Development Project that is hosted by the University of Oxford China Center. But this book is part of my doctoral research. But it actually starts earlier because before I started my PhD, I wrote another book in my native language, Dutch. And that was on a urban migrant enclave in Xiamen, where I traced the life trajectories of rural urban migrants and local residents who saw their lives being completely transformed by an encroaching city. So you have these villages amidst the city. This was back in 2009, 8, 9, 10. And after finishing this project, I was looking maybe to build on this, but also start something new, a new challenge. And I basically followed these rural urban migrants because there has been a shift in the migration frontier, you could argue, from rural to urban migration in China to rural to urban and maybe overseas migration. So this is a very similar group coming from similar backgrounds, so often from a rural background. Of course, more recently, in the past decades, Chinese migration to Africa has completely diversified, and there's many, many kind of class in terms of class, background, educational background, it has diversified. But the first who came to Ethiopia, where I did my field work, were really the construction workers who built the roads, both the engineers and the foremen who had been construction workers on the construction site. But to return to the idea for the book, it was actually just one newspaper article that triggered my, that really, gave me inspiration to look at this, which was exactly about Chinese road builders in Addis Ababa. And so I was like, this is it. Yeah.
Well, so you are an anthropologist, and we have heard another anthropologist on this series of podcasts, and she was C.K. Lee. We spoke with her about her book, The Spectre of Global China, to where we also asked her about the link between her work and the work of her former supervisor Michael Burovoy, they both worked in Ghana. And Sike Lee worked in particular in the construction industry and in the copper mining industry. So I would like to ask you, what is the relationship between you and Sike Lee? Because I know that there is one. And also how you ended selecting a different country in Africa and a different industry. You just told up somehow by curiosity, but what are the implications of those two different sectors and countries in Africa?
So my anthropology mentors always told me, when you go to the field, really concentrate on your field work, which includes listening, observing, sensing, and don't bring any books, they said, or maybe just one, just for inspiration. And so when I left for Ethiopia, that was in 2011, I brought one book with me, which was Against the Law, which is still one of my favorite books in China studies. And what I really admire of Sike Lee's scholarship is the combination of very rigorous ethnography and the bigger picture, like a broader theoretical framework that she moves between. And in my view, there are very few scholars who really can do both very well. So she was I think her type of scholarship was a main inspiration for me. In terms of the comparison between the sectors, you say, unfortunately, I have only focused on road construction, because in Ethiopia, there's very little to no mining, let alone Chinese involvement in mining. But my hunch is, reading other people's work, is that actually a lot of the miners come from similar backgrounds in China as those who work in the construction sector. And it was also part of the kind of first wave in the 90s. So road construction really took off. If you look really at Chinese road building companies as competitive contractors, so of course during the Mao period, you had a lot of aid projects where engineers were dispatched to Africa to complete these projects, often on a rotational basis, and it would return. But in the 90s, it was really Chinese companies who participated in tenders. And so the first projects they took up in Africa were often actually funded by the World Bank, the European Commission, or African governments, rather than Chinese money. So what we really tend to forget, I think, is that it was first the companies, and then during the 2000s, it was Chinese investment from the state, but also private investment kind of starting to take off.
In fact, something very interesting from the spectre of global China, basically, is that we learn that there are different types of capitalism: the state, the private, the small capitalism, Chinese capitalism in Asia, in Africa. And Sike Lee argues that the state capitalism presence of China in Africa is somehow arguably better for Africa than the private global capitalism would otherwise be. Okay, let's move now to your proper book. So we are talking about Tales of Hope, Tales of Bitterness. There are 7 chapters: Pushed to Ethiopia, Preserving Purity, The Politics of Intimacy, Fashioning Ethiopian Laborers, Inspiring Discipline, Entangled in Lawsuits, and Speaking Bitterness. So, 3 keywords: hope, taste of bitterness, and tales. So tell us about the hope and the bitterness of the Chinese in Africa.
So as an anthropologist, I was very much interested in narratives, because narratives, they tell about the self-perceptions and the perceptions of the narrators. In this case, my focus was on the Chinese workers, on work and life in Ethiopia and Ethiopian laborers they worked with. And I felt through unraveling these narratives, I was able to understand their own positions in society in China, as well as China's position, shifting position in the world. But also just their experience of daily work on the construction site. So that is the first concept of tales. Hope was a lot of workers I found had a very, especially at the beginning, just upon arriving in Africa, a hope of being able to transform, to really do something good and make something better, improving, or as they usually said, helping Africans develop. So the concept they use is yuan jian, and so help build, if you translate it literally. But the reality was much less rosy. So there was a huge discrepancy between these hopes of the will to improve and the realities on the ground, where a lot of both state officials and laborers, just ordinary rank and file workers, proved very resistant or even subversive to their activities, which they found really hard to explain. In fact, they really struggled with. So the book is really about this struggle of just to deal with these issues, but also to make sense of them. And so the bitterness really talks about the false expectations or the unmet expectations rather of their hopes.
Well, now let's move to the African side, so to the Ethiopians. And here, surprisingly, your book is a book about power and agency that you wouldn't expect in among the locals. So the humble workers, the most humble workers, and all the chain of people and institutions in Ethiopia and their interaction with the Chinese president. So surprisingly, is there agency and power among them?
So this is something that really emerged from my field work. So in my field work, I lived in engineers' camp, both on the Chinese side and the Ethiopian side, and I went to the construction site every day. So for more than a year, I was just on the construction site, observing the works, holding conversations with the foreman, the consultant engineers, the members of the Ethiopian roads authorities, and all kinds of different levels. And one thing that really struck me, and for that reason became one of the red threads in my book, is the agency of local workers and how they managed to both critique and, to a certain extent, of course, there are limits, kind of change these power dynamics to their benefit. And so, and you saw that in different forms, from very subtle forms, for instance, slowing down the work pace, or drinking a beer while working, or chewing chat, do more consequential actions like strikes, but especially Ethiopian workers started suing their employers in court. And as a lot of lawsuits were won by local workers, others took inspiration. And so there was a huge surge of Ethiopian workers suing their Chinese managers in court. And you see also this increase of legal awareness among these workers and they're kind of realizing that they have the law on their side. And this really, I thought, is very strong. So a lot of Chinese companies in the construction industry have lost a lot of money because of this. And this set in motion the kind of improvement of working conditions in terms of contractual arrangements, severance pay, kind of coverage of medical costs, but also wages. You saw them increase very, very rapidly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Very interesting. But beside the clash between Chinese and Africans, there is also another clash, which is the clash between classes, different classes of Chinese, and in particular Chinese migrants. Can you tell us about the variety of typologies of migration and migrants of Chinese in Africa and what type of interaction there were among them?
Yeah, so this is something that also really struck me. So there was actually a hierarchy among the Chinese community. And this hierarchy was based on kind of type of company you were employed by, but also background, educational background, class background in China. So what you saw, for instance, in state-owned companies, so often these construction projects are taken up by state-owned companies and then subcontracted to both privately owned and municipal or provincial level state-owned companies. And talking about state-owned companies, you had very much this dual-track system where one part of the workforce is permanently employed by the state-owned company, is really part of the company, they really own it and feel entitled, whereas one part, typically classified as the peasant worker, is only there temporarily, and they're hired for a single project or for just a number of years, and their employment is much more precarious. So you saw this kind of division within state-owned companies, but then you also had a division between the state-owned companies and the privately owned companies, because everybody was clear, if you work for a Chinese company in Africa, you try to work for a state-owned company because they provide much better conditions. And some of the private companies, it really dependent on the whim of the general manager, often how well off you were. And in some cases, there was a lot of exploitation going on, especially these private companies that emerge from work gangs that used to be working in the construction industry in China, kind of the workers being composed of place-based networks and really tight relations of obligation and debt. And you saw a lot of malpractices in these companies. But again, state-owned companies was a very different story, where actually workers have a lot of perks. So some, for instance, some of these state-owned companies, they offer a Beijing Hugo, the household registration, or they have like proper health insurance coverage and all kinds of things. And their living quarters are better, and their food is much better, so you're much more imported than the local company. So you even could see from the food they had on the table in the evenings for what company they were working.
So they were rural migrants, but with the Beijing Hukou as a benefit, they would be allowed to go back to Beijing if they wanted after the work, eh?
So if they really became permanent employees, or if they moved to kind of being part of the company, then yes. But of course, then is the question, can we afford a house in Beijing? Because you would not move back necessarily to Beijing if you cannot afford. And that is very complicated. And so what happened is that they happily took the Beijing Hukou, but they bought a house often in the capital city of their home province or a city closer to home.
Very interesting. By the way, you are elegantly understating that you are a fluent Chinese Mandarin speaker. And so the book, there are some hints that you were working with them in Chinese. For example, these two names about the two typologies of workers, the permanent and the peasants worker, the Nongming Gong, well, you will correct me. You corrected my Chinese.
Yeah.
The two typologies of workers.
That's right. So here I classify this kind of dual system where the workers part of the work unit, woman, danwei, their zhen, were classified, like kind of separated from the nongmingong or mingong.
So the Chinese firm was trying to reproduce the class system, the working class system in Ethiopia. And now you mentioned the difficulties in coming back, and you define this in the book as a one-way trip and one-way ticket to Africa to become a migrant worker abroad, and so the difficulties to coming back.
Can I
yes.
comment on this?
Oh, yes. Of course.
What is interesting and what I actually found over following these men mostly, I mostly worked with men over nearly a decade long, is that many from the beginning, they said, we only want to stay for 2-3 years and we go back home. They really had this idea of after we finish this project, we go back home. But after a certain number of years, they went from one project to another project and they felt they had bought a house, but the mortgage needed to be repaid. And there was always something more that really required them to stay. And so what happened, I found later on, is that many of these men who call moving to Ethiopia and other African countries a way out, actually find it really hard to find a way back because the lifestyle they built for themselves with the higher salary they earn in Africa, they've been able to build a urban middle-class lifestyle they can only maintain when they stay in Africa and continue working because there's no employment for them back home, or they have to compromise on a much lower salary or even switch their profession. But life in China for them, for this group of people, is very insecure. And so they opted to stay.
By the way, there is a very simple but revolutionary concept in your book, which is that developments, in fact, triggers migration, both domestic migration and international migration. So in Europe, we have this stereotype of, okay, let's help Africans in Africa or whatever developing country there, and so they will not want to come to us. Instead, the Chinese example itself is a case where development pushed people to move within the country and then to move abroad. By the way, surprisingly, you mentioned in the book that the Ethiopians were considering you somehow part of the Chinese, or if not a Chinese. How can this be possible?
Yeah, I was a little bit of an ambiguous figure, I think, because I'm white and blonde, but I did stay in the Chinese camps. I spoke Chinese, but then also in terms of gender, I wore trousers instead of skirts or dresses. And I'm talking about rural areas, right? Okay. This is very different from urban areas. So I was a little bit of an odd one, and they had a hard time kind of classifying what I was, especially children. So for little children, they hardly see white-skinned foreigners and in these regions. If they come, they kind of go like drive past very quickly in cars, and so they don't really interact with them. But so they weren't quite sure. Of course, the more educated, they were very clear of who and what I was. But often the children, they had like, China, China, and they would yell when I walked along the street.
Yeah. By the way, you worked on the local tribunals. You didn't have any hint about what was happening with the national tribunals in regulating this Chinese presence in Ethiopia?
Yeah, so I found that the local state courts, and these are the lowest level state courts, played an incredibly important role in enhancing the agency of local workers, as I said. And but the claims brought to these courts were significant, but never really crossed the line that would make them go to a higher court. So they were very numerous, but they were relatively small and contained, which is also the reason why often Chinese companies did not appeal, because it were all single, small single cases. Of course, now it has happened that there are bigger cases, especially when they concern land. They start at a higher level. So you have three levels of state courts. There's the kind of vereda, the lowest level, and then you have the zonal, and then kind of the state, the regional state level. And some even end up in the high court in Addis Ababa. So there are cases, but most of them, like the majority, really stay at the local level. But I think it's still, it doesn't say that it's meaningless, because quantity really was key and really also prevented, or not prevented, but left the Chinese kind of at odds and with their backs against the wall, because they couldn't really do anything.
Now let's move to the biggest question, which is the overall role of China, of China in Africa. You, in the introduction of the book, you tend to say that you don't want to take a strong position on this, but maybe I still will ask you, what do you think about the presence of China in Africa, and is it correct to define it as neo-colonialism as the mainstream, or at least the traditional stereotype attributes to this presence?
Yeah, so what I have wanted to do in this book is really to look at what is happening on the ground on a day-to-day basis. How do people interact? How do they overcome the linguistic, cultural, etc. barriers that are there? And so I have kind of refrained, or try to refrain, from making broad brush statements. But the reasons why I don't want to classify what is happening right now as colonialism or neo-colonialism, for that matter, is for two main reasons. The first one, and I think the most important one, is that who are you as an author or a scholar to say that a certain phenomenon is colonialism, whilst the people who are actually living this phenomenon don't classify it as such? So Ethiopians would rarely classify what is going on as colonialism, and neither would the Chinese. Of course, both sides recognize there is a symmetry in kind of power dynamics, but none of, so who am I? So there's this issue of kind of the authority of the author. This is the first one. The second one, I think asking this question, very few people ask what actually is colonialism. And colonialism often is composed of three parts. One is there is a foreign presence in a certain territory. Second, is possession of this territory. The third one is domination of this kind of locality. And perhaps we can say, yes, there is Chinese presence in Ethiopia, but then I'm hesitating to say the Chinese are possessing Ethiopia. I wouldn't say that. And I also would not argue that they're dominating the country at all. So it's very far off, I think, what is happening. And domination often, back in the day in European colonialism, happened through violence and force. So it's very far off. So I don't want to go. This is the two reasons why I don't want to go into this debate.
Very interesting. I also see that there isn't a project of exporting a religion or a cultural mainstream or another Chinese characteristic elsewhere. So I agree with your judgment. Now let's move to your next book. So I know that you are just leaving to go back to Ethiopia, where, by the way, you are able not only to communicate with the Chinese in Chinese, but also with the Ethiopians in their language. And what are you going to do? So what will be your next book?
Yeah, so the project I'm part of now looks at the legal dimension of Chinese outward investment. And I would like to build on the role of courts, or more generally disputes, dispute resolution and dispute prevention in Ethiopian Chinese encounters. And whereas this book looks mostly at labor, I now want to look at more issues that have been sources of dispute, including land, tax crime. So you have an increasing number of criminal cases, often petty crime. And so the wide range of disputes at different levels of jurisdiction. So whereas I focus on the lower level courts in my book, I now also want to look at the zonal and the higher courts. So this hopefully will be my next book. Yeah.
I'm sure it will be. And so thank you very much. In the meantime, congratulations for your current book published by Hong Kong University Press in 2019. Tales of Hope, Tastes of Bitterness, Chinese Road Builders in Ethiopia. We spoke with Dr. Miriam Duessen, which is a research associate at the China Center of the University of Oxford. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.